Understanding teen depression and ways to find help for a young person in your life. A widely publicized report in the journal Pediatrics last month contained some shocking and worrisome numbers. It showed that the prevalence of teens who have had a major depressive episode jumped dramatically in the past decade, and that now more than 11% of young people have suffered from depression. Girls suffer from depression at double the rate of boys. The problem cuts across socioeconomic groups. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn more about this alarming rise in teen depression, how to spot the warning signs and find help for a teenager in need, and how to create safer, more supportive schools and communities. Our guest, one of Maine's leading child and adolescent psychiatrists, Robin Ostrander. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Whether you have a teenager at home or you remember your own adolescence, you know that the teen years can be fraught with anxiety. This transition into adulthood often brings mood swings and stress. But that's a different story than actual depression, which is a serious mental health illness that can sometimes even lead to suicide. Recent studies show that depression among teens is on the rise, even among middle schoolers. How can you recognize teen depression, and what are the best ways to treat it? With me in the studio today, Dr. Robin Ostrander. She is medical director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Maine Medical Center and chair of the Glickman Family Center for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Spring Harbor Hospital. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have concerns about a teen family member or a friend who may be depressed? Have you suffered from depression yourself? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dr. Ostrander, thank you so much for joining us today. Recent Time magazine articles have highlighted this recent study that shows depression among teenagers dramatically rising. Why is this?
Well, thank you, Jennifer. I think that you always have to look at how you determine these numbers. And is it a sign of a trend, or is it a way that we've captured the data that is making it look different than it truly is? I think the most alarming piece to me is that child and adolescent depression has been quite common for years. It's not as if it was uncommon before and has now become common. It has always been common. Luckily, it has been treatable for a long time as well. The problem has been twofold. One is identifying children and adolescents who are depressed, and the second problem is getting them into treatment. Treatment itself is effective. So that's not the problem. It is really just figuring out who needs the help and getting them that help.
Well, let's talk about that, because teenagers are famously moody. How do you tell the difference with your teen between moodiness or serious mental illness?
Well, for many parents, the time that they observe their teenagers may famously be this time of moodiness, but isn't necessarily true for every teen. As a rule, adolescents tend to have a shift towards the negative through the teenage years. But it's not a cliff that they fall off of. It's just a shift where they become a little more negative than they were before. But it's compared to their own baseline. And for many adolescents, it is not a time of life of great tumult and fighting and differences of opinion and alienation. That in some ways may be a sort of cultural artifact, but many adolescents go through that time relatively smoothly, remaining in good relationships with their family. So for looking at any particular youth, what's most important, I think, is to compare them to themselves. So for any parent, is your child different than they were before, and different in specific ways? I'll give you a couple of those ways. So do you see low mood or down or sad mood in your child that is unrelenting? It's not in response to a disappointment. It's unrelenting. Do they appear pessimistic all the time? Do they describe lack of hope? Do they describe feeling like they are judging themselves more negatively than they ever did before? So, for example, if you have an A student who gets a B, do they describe themselves now as failures when in the past they might be really truly upset about a B if they're very high-performing students, but they're not making it go down that road of becoming an utter failure, someone who's worthless to humanity and will never actually get an A again. That's the difference. Do they become more isolated? So we all have our place on the social sort of spectrum as far as how sociable we are. Teenagers do too. So it's a shift from their normal. Some kids are very quiet and just have a core group of friends. Some kids are really outgoing and have tons of acquaintances, maybe not so many very close friends. But have they decided to cut back? And sometimes this happens incrementally and subtly, so it's hard to notice. Are they cutting back on what they used to do? Are they saying that what they loved is not fun anymore? Those are some specific signs. And then there are signs of even more severe concern that are really in the next tier.
Is it possible for teenagers to mask their depression? I mean, kids are pretty savvy. Are there kids who think this is how my parents want me to be behaving, so therefore when I'm with my parents or with my teachers, I'm going to behave this way?
Well, that's a good question. I think that it is hard. It's hard to give one answer to that. It really depends on the temperament of the child, how emotive they already are, and really what's the family culture around sharing feelings, sharing what's going on. One of the things that I recommend as parents have their children grow older is that they do everything they can to create opportunities to just sit around near your kids. So whether that is going on an activity where they're stuck in the car with you or having a dinner that's really not violatable. We all eat dinner on, maybe it's not every night, teens are busy, but it's three or four nights a week. To have these natural opportunities to see your kids where it's not some contrived circumstance where I'm going to quiz you about your day or tell you you've been breaking a rule. That will give you a chance to observe. And if they have those regular times with you, they might break if they have a bit of a veneer that they're trying to hide and feel ready to just have the conversation.
Car rides are great.
Absolutely. I like car rides and walks because you don't have to make eye contact with your children while you're talking to them. It's a much less stressful conversation when they can look at their feet or the road ahead and just talk to you. And they're unlikely to try to get away.
The study I was referencing earlier puts the teen depression rate by measuring it in terms of kids who have had a major depressive episode in the past year at 11%. Does that seem right to you?
I think that actually is low. When you look at national studies, there's one that's been around for a long time called the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, and all states participate in it to a certain degree. Maine does this every year. It happens on odd years. So we have access to the 2015 data as the most recent, quite recent. So in Maine, 38,000 public school students between the grades of 9 and 12 took the survey last year, and their incidence of major depression, now, you know, this is asking them questions about it, so it is not a clinician diagnosing them. They are self-reporting enough symptoms on that partial list I gave before to merit the diagnosis. That number was 22%. 22% of high school students in Maine identified enough symptoms to say that they had major depressive disorder. So that is actually in line with other studies, and it's not dissimilar from the U.S. overall.
22%. What is the risk? I mean, obviously, the very worst case scenario is suicide. What are some of the other bad outcomes from having to try to live with depression?
Well, any of our listeners, you, Jennifer, may know someone who's had serious depression. So there are really things that you don't do when you're ill. The same as whether you had the flu or broke your leg or were getting treated for some other illness, there are things you cannot do when you're ill. That is compounded for children because they only have so much time to get through certain milestones compared to adults. So let's say I had depression for a year as an adult, there would be many hits to my functioning, relationships, work, all sorts of things I wouldn't be able to do. As a child, if I were, say, 10 years old, that's 1/10 of my entire life is now gone. I've missed a year of school. I've missed all of the developmental milestones I should have learned in that year, socially, academically, in terms of how I manage relationships. And so for children, it's hard to get that back, even when they become well again. And so it is a much greater loss to have an episode of depression in terms of our developmental trajectory when we're children compared to adults.
I'm thinking that the long-term impact, if you multiply 22% and many of these, many if not most of these children untreated, really terrible long-term impacts, not only for individuals but for society.
Well, childhood onset depression seems to be a worse form of depression than those that first appear in adulthood. So that's a part of it, that it's just maybe a different illness. The other issue is that somewhere around half of those kids may consider suicide. Somewhere around a quarter of those kids may make a suicide attempt. So the number of kids who may complete suicide may be very small. But if you think about 11% of high school students considering suicide, it's a degree of suffering that really kind of boggles my mind when there are so many other things that high school students could be spending time thinking about.
I've read that girls are twice as likely to have depression as boys. Is that accurate, or is that, again, because they're more likely to report?
It's probably somewhat a cultural artifact where girls and women are expected to ask for help and show emotions maybe a little bit more. But that does seem to carry through adulthood studies on major depression. So there is likely some physiologic difference. It's also somewhat of a bias in who gets identified. So sometimes boys, you don't necessarily, as a child with depression, become down and not want to get out of bed or take a shower or eat. You may become agitated and irritable. And some of those kids are diagnosed with depression, maybe more likely if they're girls. Some of those kids who might be boys might be diagnosed with something else that's not depression. They may still come to our attention in mental health, but it just gets viewed through a different cultural lens.
You, near the beginning of this program, said that it is treatable. Talk about if a child finds proper care, can they be entirely – what can be expected?
Oh, absolutely.
For an outcome?
Sure. Right now, about 1 in 5 children who need treatment for any mental health issue get it. So of those 20 lucky percent, here is what they see. Now, if we could get the other 80% in, that would be ideal. The first stop is generally your pediatrician. Pediatricians are equipped to recognize depression and anxiety, and they do a very good job of helping families get to the resources they need if they need more resources than the pediatrician. Often, pediatricians work with a clinician who may be social work trained, for example, in their own office. Maine Medical Center and the outpatient affiliates have taken on this model to a significant degree. And I have a role in consulting with all of the social workers who work in the pediatric practices. So they may be providing therapy in concert with the pediatrician. That happens quite commonly. Pediatricians sometimes will recommend a certain amount of therapy, and then they'll go back in and check in with a family to see how things are going. If things are going along well, that may be it. If things aren't going well or the symptoms are quite severe, they may think about medication. And there is a long list of medications that are approved and effective for treating depression and anxiety in children. Many parents are very reluctant to consider medication for your children. I'm a parent. I understand that. What I try to tell families is the brain is an organ and it gets sick, or that you may get better without the medication. For example, I wear glasses. I could get through my day without them, but it would be a lot harder to get through my day without my glasses. And I might put other people at risk, frankly, if, for example, I'm driving a car. So providing medication to a child when a professional thinks they need it for depression is allowing them to get through faster and better. And if you think about what we talked about in terms of the time lost, we don't necessarily want kids to be ill for 3 months before they get back on track. Some of them may attempt suicide in that time, and the other ones have just lost 3 months of their lives, which is not necessary.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Dr. Ostrander, you said that depression among teenagers has been common for a long time. I think a lot of people feel as though depression rates are higher now, or problems with teenagers in general, because of the advent of the internet and specifically cyberbullying. Is there a link?
Well, the advent of access to negative feedback is a significant problem for youth. I don't know that I could give a definition of cyberbullying in one sentence that everyone would agree upon. I'm certainly no expert on it. But what I have noticed is that children who have access to each other and the media all the time have access to disappointment and trauma, essentially. So on their terms. For example, when there was no internet, someone had to call you to break up with you if you were a teenager. Now they can do it really any time of day. They can wake you up in the middle of the night when your phone pings a little sound and break up with you. And then they can tell everyone across the globe that they've broken up with you and why. That amount of exposure to shame and disappointment and relationship breakup is a huge trigger for adolescents who haven't yet developed the kind of executive function skills to temper those emotional moments. So they're at serious risk if they get broken up with in the middle of the night and no one knows but them. And they don't have friends around, they don't have their parents awake, they just suffer, and it may take a while to figure out what's going on. So in that sense, there are obviously other examples of severe harassment via the internet. But that doesn't create depression. Depression is a medical illness.
Okay. We're talking about depression with Dr. Rob, teen depression with Dr. Robin Ostrander. We do have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions, please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Apple Acres Farm. Fresh fruit, pies, gifts, and lunch in Cornish, Maine. AppleAcresFarm.com.
An illness we work really hard to hide.
Who that person was seemed shameful and bad, like a failure.
Depression is also the family secret most of us have.
Many people are actually keeping a secret from people who have the same secret from them.
I'm Guy Raz. Our mental health and the power of opening up, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us this evening at 11 o'clock. Many of your favorite Maine Public Television and PBS programs are now available to everyone online through our video on demand tool at mainepublic.org. And now, qualified supporters also have access to Passport. That'll allow extended access to many of the program archives. That'll be the ability to watch entire series or access past programs that previously may not have been available. Passport is already available to supporters of both Maine Public Television and radio at the $60 a year or $5 a month level. If you're interested in learning more or gaining access to Passport for yourself, visit mainepublic.org. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, dealing with depression among teenagers. With me in the studio, Dr. Robin Ostrander, a child and adolescent psychiatrist with Maine Medical Center. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I'm going to start with an email from Matt. He writes, we run a summer camp for teenagers only, regular kids from all over the U.S. and internationally here in Maine. We've certainly noticed a decrease in mental wellness across the board among teens in the last 10 or 15 years. but also find that after a couple good night's sleep, 9 hours a night, and a couple of days device-free, many teens report feeling less stressed and less anxious. Of course, this is purely anecdotal, so could your guests please comment if there are any established links between poor sleep habits among teen and mental health?
Oh, there are tremendous links between poor sleep and mental health for teenagers as well as adults and children. So the impact of sleep deprivation is really another whole program because it's a vast topic, but all of America is sleep deprived. So if you have a little bit of depression or anxiety and you're not sleeping, you are much more irritable. You can't see solutions very well. Your focus gets kind of narrowed. So a small problem may seem to be a big problem because there's no solution anymore. You often don't have the concentration or focus that you need. And then if you're not performing well, you're getting all sorts of negative feedback from other people about how you're not performing well, which can then be kind of a cycle on your mood, on your self-esteem. Poor sleep also leads to obesity, which is its own problem, but also a problem for self-esteem and depression for youth as sort of a risk factor. And there are functions of sleep that kind of neurologically we don't even understand yet, but the profound effects of sleep deprivation are really hard to quantify. So often when we get kids to see us, when someone sees me in the office with significant depression, if I treat their depression, they start sleeping again on their own when they had trouble sleeping. If I treat their sleep, I need to treat their depression as well. And sometimes I need to do that early on because they're so sleep deprived, they're not functioning at all and can't take advantage of really anything. There's also a funny thing that someone has, a term someone's coined called nature deficit disorder, which is not a real disorder, but the impact of spending all of your time indoors may have an effect on vitamin D levels, which may impact things like seasonal affective disorder or mood disorders. The jury's still out on that, but exercise has a really beneficial effect on mood. So sleep, exercise, and being in the sunshine are all things that this summer camp may offer that's huge positive effects for kids.
And this is a related post. This is a Facebook post. I suffered serious depression as a teen and beyond. Now, decades later, I can't say enough how important my daily practice of self-care through diet, exercise, meditation, avoiding alcohol and drugs, proper rest is in controlling this. It's very possible that poor diet and self-care was partially at the root of depression from the start. Yes, this takes my hard-earned adult discipline and something I did not have as a teen. I wish there were more programs offering these life practices to all young people as a first line of treatment and preparation for adulthood. Although young people need to sleep, they're hardwired to stay up late and eat junk food and do things that work against their mental health.
Well, one big specific issue with teenagers is they have this problem with the phase of their sleep that's out of sync with the rest of the aged population. And that is that they naturally want to stay up later and get up later. So they physically cannot often fall asleep, quote, on time in order to get there 7 or 8 or 9 hours before they get up for school. And yet school doesn't start later in many communities. Some communities, one I read about in Colorado, did a pretty crazy thing and started high school at 10 o'clock in the morning and went till 6 o'clock at night. And when you know it, but the teenagers were refreshed, they were well rested. And there were other positive effects they didn't anticipate, which is that the incidence of things like petty theft, drug and alcohol use, self-harming behavior, and suicide attempts also dropped. The idea might be that in the afternoon, after school hours, kids are up. They're often unsupervised because their parents may be working, and they can get into all sorts of trouble. When they are starting school at 10, from that 7 to 10 a.m. hour, if their parents have left for work, they're just sleeping.
We're going to go to Erin in Orono. Hi, Erin. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a comment and a question. I'm a firm believer of parental intuition, and if you think something is wrong, even if you don't know what it is, there probably is one. And there are many disorders that go hand in hand with depression as well as manic depression as you go along. And my question is, as a parent who's had experience in their child not being identified, even asking for help, how do we advocate when we know there is an issue but are not being heard by those who are supposed to be helping us?
That is a great question. I agree with parental intuition, and you can augment it by doing what I was talking about earlier and sort of cookbooking time to have with your kids so that you just see them a lot and can get more observational data.
Definitely.
It's hard to answer how you get people to answer the door when you're knocking as a parent. In some ways, you go to a different door. So if there is a mental health provider that's not listening, you call a different one. If you're having trouble with your primary care provider or your pediatrician, you go to a different one. There are crisis walk-in services. Sometimes you have to use the emergency room. Or if it is a teacher or an academic issue, sometimes you have to take it out of the school realm and take it into the medical realm, the pediatrics realm, in order to get an answer. There's also the thing which is still alive and well in medicine, which is the second opinion. Often parents will feel like the person they're working with isn't quite getting it, or the treatment they're providing to their child isn't quite what they think the child needs. You can ask, just say, hey, can we get in a second opinion? Is there someone else you'd recommend? Or you call your own insurance company and find out who might offer that. I hope that that's helpful.
Thank you for your call, Aaron. We'll move to Topsom and Dennis. Hi, Dennis. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Yes. Hi. How are you? What a great show.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, listen, I sort of am of a mind that there's an outside chance some children are just sort of falling through the cracks. And what I'd like to do is just point out as an observation that I have two biological granddaughters, twins. They're 15 years old. They're they're my son's kids. And his ex-wife left him 11 years ago. And he's since hooked up with another woman who has two daughters as well, and they're 15 and 17. Out of the four girls, two of them have been diagnosed as depressed, and one of them has left home to just sort of emancipate herself, and the other one is just sort of hanging on. And as a grandparent, I noticed that my son's ex-wife had three other children, and of those three children, all of them have been diagnosed with various disorders, and they're not really functioning, and I've been within 10 miles of this for, and my wife is a shining beacon to all of these kids. And yet it seems like there's nothing that we can do to really aid them because sometimes their parents think that they know best, and yet all of these children are sort of slipping through the cracks. So is this a national dilemma, or is this just specific to parents that, are unable to really help their children?
Wow, that's a big question. I really feel for the situation you're in of observing things not going well and not knowing how to help or trying to help and having it not be accepted. There are always families who struggle. Sometimes we refer to them as multi-stressed families. So often when a family may not be identifying or getting the treatment for their children that someone else might think is necessary, it's because there's a lot of stress on that family system. So sometimes helping that can then help parents be the parents they would otherwise be. They can sort of rise up in their parenting skills. So if it's an issue of poverty or job loss, sometimes it's mental illness and addiction in the parents, sometimes domestic violence, just a long list of other potential stresses to that family. If you can help or help them get access to their own treatment as parents, then they may be more receptive or even just have kind of the bandwidth in their day to deal with the treatment their children need.
Do you see depression running in families for genetic reasons as well?
Absolutely. There's mounds and mounds of evidence. So sometimes it's just, I will tell children sometimes they have bad luck in addition to genetics, because the genetics doesn't tell the whole story. We don't always know why one person gets depressed and another doesn't. It is not a result of poor parenting. But yes, it absolutely runs in families.
Thank you, Dennis, for your question, and good luck to your family. We have an email from Jessica. How often do doctors look to see if these young ones do not produce the enzyme that breaks down toxins and therefore don't absorb B vitamins? And how important is proper diet and exercise and no caffeine to treating these children?
Oh, that's a great question. One of the problems with medical education in the United States is that we, in medical school, I did not get enough education on nutrition. So it has been something that's been recognized and is getting better, but each of us has to kind of learn it as we go along. So there's incredible variability among physicians for our level of knowledge and expertise in nutrition and nutritional disorders. The issue of specific vitamin deficiencies, we don't often see. Sometimes the children will get referred to us who have known enzymatic or genetic deficiencies around metabolism, and that's really a small subset. But overall, a diet that is not rich in vitamins, including B vitamins, is a problem. And specifically, caffeine is a problem, more so for youth than it was maybe 15 years ago in my practice.
And we have an email from Janice, who's a psychiatrist in Islesboro. There's a body of research on the mental and physical impact of adverse childhood experiences, ACEs. Does the biennial data collected on rates of teen depression include any data on ACE or ACE scores?
That is a fantastic question. I would love to do another talk with you, Jennifer, about the ACE study and ACE score. So adverse childhood experiences are things that are specific. There's a specific list of them. And they include having parents who were killed, incarcerated, abused drugs or alcohol. So things that happened around you. They include divorce or separation of your parents or your separation from them. They also include things that could happen to us personally, such as violent crime, sexual crime, neglect, other forms of abuse. So the number of those situations or, you know, childhood experiences is very highly predictive of multiple poor health outcomes, not just mental health outcomes, medical health outcomes such as diabetes, lung cancer. So it is really remarkably damaging to the whole physiology of a human to have adverse experiences in childhood. So medically, we become different people. Maybe some of that is mediated through risky behaviors. So cigarette smoking mediates some of the risk for lung cancer, for example, but not all of it. So non-smokers still get more lung cancer if they have more adverse childhood experiences. Maybe that's immune system. We really don't know. The question of the doctor who called, I don't know the exact answer to whether the ACE study is integrated with that youth risk behavior survey. It ought to be, but I don't know that. There are many questions on that youth risk behavior survey, but they tend to be really focused on what's happening to a child right now.
And we've really only been focusing on these ACE indicators for about a decade now. I remember it's a pretty recent a part of our conversation.
Oh, absolutely. There was an interesting white paper put together by an attorney who does pro bono work on behalf of children in Texas. And I would love to talk about it because it involved the economic impact of child maltreatment in the United States. And it was around the level of what we spend on health care in the United States every year is the economic impact. And he had this complicated metrics to quantify the loss of productivity of, for example, children who are killed, children who are incarcerated, children who end up using the legal system or welfare system or educational supports. All of those things cost money. If you have adverse childhood experiences, you're unlikely to attain the same educational level that you otherwise would have based on your own kind of inborn cognitive horsepower. That has a cost to society. So the sad part was that this white paper was delivered because somehow as a society, we haven't changed our focus to try to get rid of child maltreatment because it's wrong. So he thought that maybe we could convince people to get rid of child maltreatment because it's costly and the United States just won't function anymore, and the healthcare system won't function anymore unless we can stop abusing and neglecting children.
We're talking about adolescent depression. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Condo Furniture by Endicott Home, offering non-toxic solutions for downsizing and living well in smaller spaces. CondoFurniture.com. And Casella, handling over 1 million pounds of recyclables daily in Maine through its Zero Sort program. Casella, giving resources new life.
Maine Public is announcing an exciting new comprehensive fundraising campaign, the largest in our history. $30 million, which is helping this organization grow to meet the needs of our diverse audience. We're calling it Charting a Bold Future, and the effort is designed to improve and expand our news coverage, grow our FM classical music network, make online programming even more widely available, while strengthening our overall organization. To learn how you can contribute and support Charting a Bold Future, go to mainepublic.org and click on the red donate button on the top right of the screen.
And coming up in about 20 minutes in our 2 o'clock public affairs hour, World Affairs. We'll be discussing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict perspectives from both sides. That's in 20 minutes here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, finding ways to address teen depression. With me today in the studio, Dr. Robin Ostrander. She is Medical Director of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Maine Medical Center. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Robin, what do we know about how to set a kid up for success?
Oh, that's a lovely question. Sometimes turning this around, as you've just done, is the thing to do. First is to help children feel like they matter. In that Youth Risk Behavior Survey of 2015, which we've been talking about, almost the most alarming statistic to me was that only slightly more than half of the 38,000 high school students in Maine said, "I matter to people in my community." So the other half said that they don't. So how do we make children feel like they matter? And there's actually research that determines what helps children do well, all things being equal. One of them is that children are likable. Well, that is culturally driven in some ways. Children who are attractive, who are tall, who have white skin, life goes easier for them in some ways. But there are inherent likable features of every person. In psychiatry, I'm trained to find them so that I can connect with people and help them. But as lay people, we can do that too. If there is a child you know that's troubled, find something likable about them and let them know that you know what it is, and make that a basis for your conversation, because you are making them matter to you. You could save their lives doing that. Another factor to help things go right for children is to support them being really good at something. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be their brine shrimp collection. It doesn't have to be a sport. It doesn't have to be an academic. It could be anything. But having one thing that a child is good at, that others will recognize that they are good at, is hugely supportive to their overall well-being and their trajectory. And the last thing is to have at least one adult that gives a darn about a child. That's how you set them up for success. Luckily, we can make all sorts of other parenting mistakes, and children generally turn out just fine. But there are children, unlucky enough or by circumstance, don't have a parent in their lives who is able to provide that. And so we can do that. If we volunteer, sometimes you take someone under your wing, the friends of your own children. Sometimes you're a coach. Sometimes you just know the kids who come into the store where you work. You can connect and be available to children, and that will set them up well.
We're going to go to Jacko, who's calling from Abbott. Go ahead, Jacko. You're on the air.
Hi. You sound like a really good doctor. I had, many years ago, experienced the psychiatric system as a child, and I had a pretty horrible experience about it, being medicated with medications that basically gave me very bad side effects, and I noticed many of the doctors wouldn't, they really wouldn't even converse with me at all, but they would just be quick to give out some form of medication, and I think people should really take a good look at the side effects and see that, you know, there's big risks and maybe there's other options. For me, I think if I had gone to, like, maybe a therapist who talked to me and tried to connect with me, would have been a lot more effective or done activities. But as soon as I was able, I got off the medication and found alternative methods to take care of the unique situation going on with, I guess, my brain chemistry.
Jacko, how long ago were you a child dealing with doctors who are prescribing this medication?
The 80s and the 90s.
80s and 90s. And I ask that question because, Dr. Ostrander, are there different medications prescribed now, or is it really the same kind of medicines?
To some degree, yes, the medications are different. Others are the same. There is always the imperative for all physicians to do no harm. And so it's my duty. I hope it would be the duty of every physician to look at that balance. Every medication has potential side effects, some of them very severe. So you have to look at the severity of the condition you're treating and the preferences of the person and their family. Often children are in a position where all of their care is delivered on an involuntary basis because their parents call the shots. That requires an even higher level of really kind of service that I have to provide to a child. Sometimes I have to get in the middle of a child and a guardian to argue on behalf of what I think is the child's best interest and ultimately think about, well, 10 or 20 years from now, would this child be okay with the decision I'm making? And it's often really hard, and it pains me to hear your story, Jacko. And I'm also so, I'm admiring of the fact that you found your own way to get through and that you're here. So I thank you for calling. My sense is that medications should almost never be used without therapy for children. And the only reason I say almost is because there's one condition, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, that's got quite a bit of research evidence that if you're treating just that and you add therapy, it doesn't make any difference at all. It's the medications that treat this chemical imbalance in the brain. Basically, all other childhood conditions require therapy to help children, and often as the very first step, unless they are so ill that we are really worried about their safety.
Thanks for your call, Jacko. We're going to go to Camden and Peter. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I wanted to describe a situation that we had 10 years ago when my daughter was 15. And she had an undiagnosed episode of anxiety and depression. And it got to the point we tried to care for her at home, but she wouldn't sleep at all. And that went on for 10 or 12 days. We took her to the hospital eventually when she became what I would call psychotic. They, at the local hospital, at Tembe Medical Center, were unable to diagnose the situation. We spent 3 or 4 days there in an emergency room situation, and then she was transferred to Spring Harbor in Portland. They quickly diagnosed her with an illness that she didn't ultimately have. They told us that she had schizophrenia. She had become psychotic because she had not slept at that point in, 20 days. And they wanted us to start her on a course of medication to treat schizophrenia. We were able to get her out of that hospital against doctor's orders to a hospital, the Children's Hospital in Boston. Within 24 hours, they diagnosed her with anxiety, depression, and over time, we're able to get her to sleep. And 10 years later, she's, doing quite well. Finished college, has a good job. but still has bouts of depression. But we came so close to treating her poorly and improperly, because the doctors, literally, when they told my wife and I she had schizophrenia, it was a two-minute conversation in a doctor's office with no eye contact, no explanation. They said they knew better than we did. This is what she had. She had to have the medicine, period.
And so this was 10 years ago, Peter. Dr. Ostrander, how common is Peter's story, this misdiagnosis and feeling as though the docs just don't get your kid?
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that you went through all this, and so glad to know that your daughter's doing well and found the treatment that she needed and the proper identification. One of the things that psychiatry has struggled with and continues to, although there is much light in the tunnel, is appropriate diagnosis of children. It's only within the last couple of decades that the psychiatric establishment even agreed that children could have illnesses like depression and bipolar disorder. They were thought not to appear until adulthood. And the only reason we had to admit that they did is because we talked to people with these adult versions of the disorder and went back in time and determined when their symptoms had their first onset, which was usually during childhood or at least the teen years. But in an episode such as you describe for your daughter, when someone presents to the emergency room, it is often not easy at all to determine what's going on. And I'm not defending anyone, but I've gotten it right and I've gotten it wrong in that first day, in that first assessment, even in the first week or two. The brain is very complicated and we don't have a playbook. And children can sometimes, often, not follow the rules around how the psychiatric disorders present. We don't have enough data. We don't do enough studies involving children as participants to know all the ways in which a child will present clinically. So often it is time that will help us figure out the diagnosis, not improved tools. We don't have a brain scan. We don't have blood tests. We don't have a lot of the tools that we've developed for other systems of the body because we don't have the money for research, you know, to a certain degree. So it is difficult, and yet we don't want to get it wrong because these are children. So it's such a shame to hear that you had a hard time with your daughter, and also so good to hear that over a week, maybe 2 weeks, you had the right diagnosis, which sometimes is really hard to come by.
We're going to move on to Gabrielle, who's calling from Hope. Hi, Gabrielle. Go ahead. Gabrielle, are you there? Okay. Sorry, we've lost you, Gabrielle. Go to an email from Anne. My daughter's a year into treatment for an eating disorder, which comorbidly exists with depression. Medication can help the depression, but it does not help the intense emotional pain she is feeling, and I have no words or actions that can offer comfort to her. If it were physical pain, I would advocate for a strong pain reliever. Is there anything that can take the edge off of her not wanting to live with this feeling? Note, she is currently inpatient.
The treatment of eating disorders comorbid with depression is very difficult. Anorexia nervosa specifically has one of the highest mortality rates of any psychiatric disorder, by all causes and by suicide. It's a terrible, terribly severe illness for many kids. Many of them will regain a great degree of function over time, but they tend not to be completely free of symptoms. So it's really tough. How to provide solace or hope? I'm wondering if that's really what the question is about. Sometimes people will ask me what I do. You know, are you a medication provider? What do you do? Do you just provide psychiatric diagnoses? And I'd like to consider myself a healer, but sometimes I feel like I'm more like a tour guide, which is really just to sit with someone, not to literally hold their hand, but to sit next to them and try to see out the same view that they're seeing. Combine it with my own view that came from my medical training, and find cause for hope, find things that we can recognize as small gains So looking for small areas of improvement and not dismissing them is very important. And just being a witness, you don't have to necessarily solve the problem. Sometimes they're unsolvable, but having a companion to help witness what your child is going through is incredibly powerful, and they don't feel alone.
Thank you for your email, Anne. Dr. Ostrander, I think I want to end by asking the broad question, what if I'm worried about someone, a teenager I know? How do I seek help? How do I seek help in Maine, in rural Maine?
Well, there's a system. There are multiple health systems in Maine. The system that I'm in is a combination of Maine Medical Center, Department of Psychiatry, and a larger organization called Maine Behavioral Healthcare that really offers multiple nodes of service. So we have crisis teams that will go to a house or a school. We have outpatient therapists and psychiatrists. We have crisis units. We serve emergency departments. We have inpatient programs. And we work to integrate with primary care. So there is a phone number nationwide called 211 that you can call for help. You can use the internet. The internet is your friend to just say, resources for mental health in Maine for children. And you can go to your pediatrician to get recommendations, because increasingly pediatricians know where to find people. At Maine Medical Center, what we offer in the Department of Psychiatry is a one-time consultation regardless of geography, because we know many families are many hours from the Portland area or from a child psychiatrist, and we can't pretend to serve everyone directly with that distance, although we're increasingly trying to use video and telehealth as options. We can meet you and your family in person for one or two visits and try to figure out what's going on, and then learn everything we can about what resources are in your community and try to direct you to them. So that may be an option as well.
And you would say don't wait.
No, don't wait, because by the time you've decided it's time, your child has probably been suffering for a while, and no treatment starts to work the day you begin. So just get the ball rolling. You won't regret it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Robin Ostrander, Medical Director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Maine Medical Center. She's also Chair of the Glickman Family Center for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Spring Harbor Hospital. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. You can find past editions of this program, as well as a link to our archives, at mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, just in time for those last-minute gifts, we will rebroadcast our Maine Calling Made in Maine Holiday Gift Guide. That's tomorrow at 1 and again at 8. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to the public.